listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. Today is Monday, November 23rd. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear the first half of an interview with Scott Russell Sanders, author of the new book, A Conservationist Manifesto, published by Indiana University Press. Distinguished professor of English at Indiana University Bloomington, Scott Russell Sanders is the author of 20 books of fiction and nonfiction, including Writing from the Center, Hunting for Hope, and A Private History of Awe. He is winner of the Lannan Literary Award, John Burroughs Essay Award for Natural History, AWP Award in Creative Nonfiction, and the 2009 Mark Twain Award. I interviewed Scott Russell Sanders earlier this month when he was in Burlington to speak at the Fletcher Free Library. We began by discussing how he came to write A Conservationist Manifesto.
When this book came out in April of 2009, on Earth Day, that day I received an email message from a librarian who said it had just arrived in her library and she was alarmed by the title. So I wrote her back and I said, well, I can't know why you were alarmed by the title, but I suspect it's because you heard an echo of, or thought you heard the echo of, a communist manifesto. And I just want to assure you, I wrote to her, that there's nothing in here about communism, but it is a manifesto. And I reminded her in my little note that this country was founded with a manifesto called the Declaration of Independence. And in fact, artists frequently have manifestos. And I wrote a book which is designed to raise questions about the way of life, our present economy, the notion that we are consumers, that we should identify ourselves as consumers, a book that really challenges what the media tell us should be the American way of life, the desirable way of life. And it is a kind of confrontational book. And that's why I use the term manifesto. But a manifesto is a public declaration of values and principles and plans of action, mm-hmm. as of, was the Declaration of Independence. So I see A Conservationist Manifesto as a book which seeks to articulate what's required to shift from a culture based on consumption, which is the one we live in, to a culture based on caretaking, on stewardship, mm-hmm. on looking after one another, looking after the planet, looking after human artifacts as well as natural artifacts, as well as natural resources. It's a book of essays which were written separately, but they all have to do with this need to shift from, as I said, a culture of consumption to a culture of caretaking. Mm-hmm.
You structure the book around three areas of care: caring for Earth, caring for home ground, and caring for generations to come. I'm curious how you decided on these categories.
Well, the first one, caring for Earth, is more traditional in its focus. It talks about what conservation is. And conservation, in my conception, is not just a concern for soils and waters and air and forests and so forth. And of course, it includes those things. But it's also a concern for things that humans have made that are valuable, like the library that we happen to be sitting in right now here, the Fletcher Free Library in Burlington, which is a human construction. A conservationist, as I see such a person, is someone who is concerned to preserve and to nurture all those things that are required for human flourishing. And that obviously includes what some people call natural resources, but it also includes human resources, cultural resources. So conservationist is not someone who's just concerned with the environment, nor is the conservationist just concerned with human artifacts and human structures, but rather with the whole range of things that human well-being depends on. We talk about conserving paintings. We talk about conserving old buildings. We talk about conserving land, conserving water, etc., conserving energy. Mm-hmm. So a conservationist is someone who is concerned with what's required for human well-being and taking care of those things. The first part of the book, Caring for the Earth, is really about that range of concerns and range of ideas. The second, Caring for Home Ground, is written about my home ground, which happens to be the Midwest, and in particular the state of Indiana, and within the state of Indiana, the hill country of southern Indiana. So there's a series of essays which are about that region. But the larger purpose of that central section is to invite the reader to think about what his or her own home ground is. We all live somewhere. And the book is an invitation partly to be more aware of, more attentive to the place where we actually come from. So the central section, Caring for Home Ground, is that sort of an invitation. By my talking about how I see myself situated in place and what goes into the sense of place for me, inviting the reader to think about where he or she would identify as home ground and what are the elements of that, what are the qualities of that place that matter to them. And again, I include natural qualities, geology, forests, birds, etc., as well as human qualities, the architecture, the cuisine, the ceremonies and festivals and so forth that are distinctive of that place. So that's what the central section is about. And the third section, Caring for Future Generations, as the title suggests, invites the reader to think about how our present way of life affects the prospect for people who are going to live here after us. My wife and I became grandparents 6 years ago when a granddaughter named Elizabeth was born to our daughter. Since then, two more granddaughters have been born, and a fourth granddaughter is expected by our son and his wife within a month of our sitting here right now, mm-hmm. in December of this year. Becoming a grandparent cast my thoughts further into the future. It's obviously not only my own relations, my own literal grandchildren that I care about. I care about the prospects for all future children. And it seems to me that if we took into account more seriously the effects of our present way of life on the prospects for future generations, we would live more conservingly. Let me apply that, for example, to the so-called debate about climate destabilization. Mm-hmm. That climate destabilization is the term that I prefer to climate change or global warming. The people who say we shouldn't do anything about, we shouldn't conserve petroleum, we shouldn't conserve gasoline, we shouldn't conserve electricity, and we shouldn't worry about releasing carbon into the atmosphere, greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, for two reasons, they say. One is it will hurt the economy, and the second is that we enjoy our way of life. And in any case, they say the science is uncertain. Maybe we're not actually affecting. Maybe we're not causing the planet's climate to become unstabilized. Well, my response to that is, what's wrong with conserving things, regardless of whether or not we're destabilizing the climate? Why shouldn't we conserve water? Why shouldn't we conserve petroleum? Why shouldn't we reduce the amount of coal we burn so that there will be more for future generations to use? In other words, living conservingly makes sense regardless of whether or not we are destabilizing the climate. I happen to believe, I'm absolutely utterly convinced that the vast majority of scientists, atmospheric scientists, who say that the release of greenhouse gases, that release is destabilizing the climate, I think they're probably right. But even if they're wrong, why not conserve? It seems to me to make good sense. And if we care about the quality of life that children of the future will inherit from us, if we care about that, then we should live more conservingly. And as to the other argument, the argument that, oh, it will hurt the economy to charge, for example, for the release of carbon into the atmosphere, how could any conservation measure hurt the economy more than our financial institutions have hurt it in the last 2 or 3 years? Mm-hmm. The unemployment, the loss of value, the people's pensions wiped out, and so forth. Our financial institutions have caused more economic damage than any environmental or conservation legislation could possibly do. So the last section of the book really is an invitation to think harder about the effects of our present way of life, our present decisions, harder about how those will affect future generations. And one way I phrase this is to say, when legislators are sitting in their committee rooms debating laws, when executives are sitting in their boardrooms planning, making corporate decisions, when mayors are sitting in their offices, I wish there were a few children over in the corner playing quietly, reading, coloring, just lying on the carpet, playing, so that the men, and they're typically men, but also the women making those decisions, would look over once in a while at those children and realize that these decisions they're making about waging wars, about closing plants and opening plants, about the legislation that they're considering, these decisions do not just affect the lobbyists. They do not just affect corporate balance sheets. They affect the fate of children now and in the future. Mm-hmm. So that's what the third part of the book is about.
Did you write these essays and then start deciding how you wanted to group them in a collection, or did you sort of set out with this structure in mind and then start writing?
It was the latter. I had some scheme, some vision of the overall structure of the book, and then as I wrote separate essays, either because they were written to be delivered as keynote addresses or endowed lectures here, there, and yonder around the country, or they were written for national conferences of one sort or another, I fit those essays into that larger scheme. Mm-hmm. I've been preoccupied with issues of, human well-being since I was a teenager and right through college. Early on, I thought primarily about matters of discrimination and warfare, and obviously the civil rights movement, for example, had a tremendous impact on forming my concerns, forming my values when I was a boy and right through college and beyond. The women's movement also had a big impact on me, beginning to learn about what had been the condition of women, the restraints on women's development throughout history everywhere, but especially in this country. And the Vietnam War also had a tremendous impact in forming my ideas about human well-being. So my early concerns when I thought about what do humans need to live well? Mm-hmm. They need peace, they need justice, they need educational opportunities. But I didn't think that much about environmental matters. I didn't think that much about nature, because it didn't occur to me when I was a teenager and really right through college that nature was endangered. But as history itself, of course, has unfolded since I was a college student back in the 1960s, but also as my reading and my traveling and just my reflection has deepened, I've become aware, of course, that the living systems on Earth that we depend on and that other species depend on are, in fact, damaged and have been compromised by human behavior. We're using up irreplaceable resources at a breakneck pace. We're causing the extinction of other species at a rate that scientists estimate is between 100 and 1,000 times as high a rate as the natural background extinction rate. We're deforesting, we're fishing the oceans bare, that is, we're harvesting fish beyond a sustainable level, so that gradually I came to realize that human well-being doesn't just depend on fair laws, on a peaceful society, on equal opportunities, on high-quality education. Obviously, all those things are crucial to our well-being, but they're not sufficient. Because we could have the best laws in the world, we could have the most humane society in the world, and if we so degrade the planet that we and future generations suffer from that degradation, then all those efforts at fixing the human world, if you will go to naught, because mm-hmm. people will still suffer. Right now, in this country, we still, because of our wealth, because of our natural wealth, because of the abundance of arable land, for example, in this country, very few Americans are suffering directly from environmental degradation. But right now around the world, elsewhere in the world, on the order of 1 billion human beings are suffering hunger, or they're suffering through civil wars, or they're forced to be refugees because of the degradation of land, because of drought caused by climate destabilization, because of the exhaustion of water resources. And so environmental suffering is going on right now to a lot of human beings. People in this country tend not to be aware of that unless they really make a point of informing themselves about it, because we're still relatively insulated from that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So my history of learning gradually to recognize the crucial importance of the health of natural systems, crucial importance to our own well-being, that's been a gradual process that began really when I was a graduate student in the late 1960s, early 1970s, and continues to this day.
Mm-hmm. Early in the Conservationist Manifesto, in an essay called Building Arcs, you describe the shutdown of a protest in your area of Indiana. A group of activists was stopped by police, and when they tried to interfere with the construction of an apartment building that was in a 50-acre wood. Later in the essay, you describe these activists and people like them as the builders of arcs. And you say that they have, this is a quote from the book, the wisdom necessary for dwelling in a place generation after generation without diminishing either the place or the planet. Can you talk a little bit about this incident and your reaction to it?
Well, there have been young people, there's typically young people, but there have been people across the country who have tried to defend forests by illegally building little temporary structures up in the trees. There's the famous cases recently with redwoods in California, but it's happened elsewhere, including in my hometown of Bloomington, Indiana, where, again, typically young people building structures up in trees and camping out there, sometimes even chaining themselves to the trees to try to stop or at least slow down so-called development. It's heartrending for me to see how the forces of the police, the forces of the media, the forces, of course, of the chambers of commerce and the banks, how they're always on the side of what they call development, and never on the side of nature. To be on the side of nature, so for example, to think that to have a forest on the edge of a city is more valuable than to have yet one more apartment complex on the edge of a city. There's nobody really in the power structure speaking on behalf of the forest. They're all speaking on behalf, basically, of money. So I'm very grateful to the people of all ages, young or old, who speak up on behalf of nature. When in doing so, of course, they're also speaking on behalf of other species, plants and animals. So they're birds and butterflies and other creatures that can live in those habitats that are protected. But also humans need access to natural land, not necessarily deep wilderness. I love deep wilderness, and every inch of it that we have we should preserve, but every city, every town, every village needs nearby natural lands where people can go for walks, can look for mushrooms, can listen to the stream rumble over the rocks. If we don't have access to natural land, we tend to fall into the illusion that we own the earth, that we run the earth, that we are the masters of the earth, which of course we are not. We are incapable of providing the conditions that we need to flourish on Earth, incapable of producing those on our own.
Mm-hmm.
We depend on the health of living systems of the Earth. So I call the tree sitters, these people who were arrested, and charges were eventually dropped because the community, so much of the community actually spoke up on behalf of the tree sitters who were accused of trespassing and resisting arrest and various other things. They weren't violent. They were very peaceful, but they didn't go. They had to be dragged out of the trees and so forth. So I write about them, and I call them ark builders. And let me say just a word about that metaphor of the ark. Most people, whether or not they've ever opened the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament, as it's often called, and read the book of Genesis, the story of Noah and the ark, even if they've never read that, they probably know the gist of the story. At the heart of the story is the idea that Noah was instructed by the Creator to put on the ark not only human beings, his family, so that after the flood, when the ark returned to dry land, humankind could be restored. But the Creator also instructed Noah to put on the ark a breeding pair of every species. Every species. The instruction is not the ones that are good to eat, or the ones that are pretty, or the ones that don't bite you or sting you, but all species. And so long before there was any formal concept of ecology, let alone the word, it is actually an ecological parable. It's a story which says that through times of trouble, through times of destruction, it's crucial that we protect, that we preserve that which is needed to restore the earth. And in the story of Noah and the ark, what's needed is not only humans on the ark, but all other species on the ark. So after the flood recedes and the ark lands, Noah and all the other creatures get off the ark. And in the book of Genesis, it tells how the Creator says to Noah that I make a covenant with you, I make a promise to you, which will be symbolized by the rainbow, that I will never again flood the earth and destroy human beings. But I also make that covenant with all the creatures that were on the ark with you. So it's a sort of promise from the Creator what we now call biodiversity, that the whole range of living species are inherently valuable. They are worthy in their own right, not because of what we make of them or because how they matter to us, but they have an inherent right to existence. That's what that story tells us. So I think, well, what is the ark? The ark, that boat, okay, it's a boat. But what is it metaphorically? What it is metaphorically is a vessel, a container that holds that which must not perish, that which we need to preserve so that we can restore, or we can bring human communities, and we can bring the earth itself back to a state of health. Mm-hmm. So biodiversity clearly is vital, but so are various human skills. Books are arcs. Libraries are arcs. Many institutions, public access radio stations, I would argue, are arcs. That is, they hold a possibility, they preserve a possibility through times when those possibilities are under assault. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the possibility of non-commercial public conversation which doesn't require pandering to big corporations in order to be on the air. That's vital to the health of a democracy and to the health of a vibrant culture. Well, the public television and public, both public access and also PBS and national public radio, but also public access radio in towns and cities across the country, are themselves arcs that hold these possibilities, that carry them. So I began thinking about the various ways in which, or the various kinds of arcs. So when a city or a nonprofit land trust protects a piece of land so that the people of the city and visitors to the city can walk along the riverfront, or walk along, in this case, along the lakefront, that piece of land itself is an ark. It preserves certain possibilities, certain kinds of experiences that will disappear if those places are paved over or turned into apartment complexes or Walmart parking lots, that will disappear unless they're preserved. So a park can be a vessel, a book can be a vessel, an institution, a community chorus, keeping a certain kind of musical life going in a community. Those are various sorts of arcs. One of my ambitions in the book, in writing the book, was to speak to people for whom the Judeo-Christian religious tradition is very important. And that includes, of course, a lot of Americans. By drawing on some of the major teachings of the Bible, such as the teaching implicit in the story of Noah and the Ark, mm-hmm. drawing on a number of the dominant teachings in the Bible to show their implications for a life of conservation, for a concern for protecting the earth and the full diversity of life on earth. There are a lot of other kinds of arguments that go through the book, based on science, based on practicality, based on common sense, and so forth. But one thread that goes through the book is this appeal to certain fundamental teachings, as I see them, of the biblical tradition. And the Hebrew Bible, or the so-called Old Testament, is shared, of course, by Jews, by Christians, by Muslims. So it's one of the single most widely read and thought about and influential texts that humans have ever created. And it's filled, of course, with lots of contradictory sorts of teachings, a whole range of teachings. And you can find in the Bible justification for a dominating view towards the earth. And that tends to be the one that gets picked up. And because people, it's very flattering to humans to be told or to think that we are the center and the purpose of creation. I happen to believe that's not true, but at least you can find a justification for that in the Bible. But you also find a very powerful tradition in the Bible, both the Old Testament and the New Testament, a very powerful strain of thought and teaching which tells us that we are guests on earth, that we are here to experience, to learn from, but not to own, not to dominate the earth. We're here as guests just passing through. And I think that's the more profound teaching.
I want to talk a tiny bit more about that essay. You later list the reasons that are generally given for this sort of development, for the apartment complexes and such, that people need somewhere to live, people need jobs, investors deserve a return on their capital, the city must grow, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So how do we reconcile these needs with all that's being sacrificed, or vice versa, do you suppose?
It's hard. The average size of the American house, the newly constructed house, has increased by 50% since 1970, while family sizes have declined. So one of the reasons there's so much sprawl in America is that people are building bigger and bigger houses for smaller and smaller families. That takes up more land, it takes up more wood, it takes up more copper for the wiring, it takes up more light fixtures, more furnishings, etc. Measured sheerly by its contribution to the gross domestic product, that's all good. Measured by its impact on the earth and on the prospects for future generations, it's bad. It's wasteful. We would require much less land if we built smaller houses, smaller apartments, if we built more densely instead of spreading houses way out in the suburbs, if we concentrated housing more. Yes, people do need some place to live. There's no shortage of housing in America. There's a shortage of affordable housing, but there are a lot of unsold houses in America and unsold apartments and abandoned buildings. One of the things we could do, and Burlington, I think, from my impression, has done a pretty good job of this, is to reclaim a lot of abandoned buildings that had some prior use as a warehouse or a factory even, and now have been reclaimed for condominiums or for apartments, so that you maintain a more compact footprint for the city. So sprawl, it seems to me, is driven both by our moving to grander and more palatial kinds of housing, but also it's driven by the lack of intelligent city planning, community planning. If we allow developers, in effect, to drive the shape of the cities, they have no regard whatsoever for the overall shape of the city. They're just concerned with how much money they can make from a particular development. There are some exceptions, some developers who are sincerely concerned about the quality of life in their community, but frankly, most aren't. Many of them don't even live in the cities where they're funding the developments. And yet in this country, especially the further west you move from New England, the more resistant people tend to become to the whole idea of civic planning. If people say, oh, government, I don't want government to control what I do with my land. Well, it's not government, it's your fellow citizens. That's government, for better or for worse, is our best mechanism for expressing, for seeking to serve the common good, the public good, for asking, what does the community need here? Will the community benefit from having this sprawl over here, or will the community be better off if we have more compact development? That's a kind of question that corporations are never going to ask themselves. Developers are never going to ask themselves. The only people who can ask that are citizens, and the only way they can express it is through their government. So we need better planning across this country at the local, state, and national level, regional and national level. We need much more vigorous concern for and defense of the common good, the public good, to ask of every project, what's the effect of this going to be on the community? Not who's going to benefit financially. Those folks will look out for themselves. We don't have to worry about that. But what will be the effects on the community? And some developments are beneficial for the community, and some are disastrous for the community. And a lot of sprawl is driven by corporate and private development, private investor decisions that benefit a small number of people and damage the community. So that's one issue. The other issue is jobs. People say anything that hurts jobs is bad. Anything that creates jobs is good. Well, there are a lot of different ways to generate jobs. For example, economists have shown repeatedly in studies since the 1960s, for every dollar that you spend on education, you create three times as many jobs as you do for every dollar you spend on the military. Mm. For every dollar that you spend on insulating houses, retrofitting houses, putting new windows in an old house, putting insulation in the walls and in the ceiling, putting in a more efficient furnace, for every dollar you spend doing that, retrofitting old buildings to save energy, you create three times as many jobs as you do through putting another dollar to support the financial industry. So the question is, what are the jobs that we want? Do we want more soldiers? Do we want more drug dealers? Do we want more prison guards? Do we want more mechanics fixing badly manufactured automobiles? Or would we rather have more teachers in smaller classes? Would we rather have more doctors? Would we rather have more nurses? Would we rather have more artists? In other words, jobs are not all equally valuable to humankind. And many of the jobs that exist in our society now, and many of the ones, unfortunately, that were not fortunately or unfortunately, that were have been lost in this current economic debacle that we're suffering through, I'm not sure we want back. For example, when one of the first effects of the rapid increase in gasoline prices was that the recreational vehicle industry suffered a precipitous decline. And Indiana, my home state, is one of the major focuses, one of the major centers for the manufacture of these big bus-type recreational vehicles. And many of those plants have shut down or they've cut way back. And I feel for the families who've lost those jobs, but I don't aspire to a society, to a future economy that will recreate all those jobs, not manufacturing big recreational vehicles. The earth can't afford it. The future can't afford it. I'd rather have those people with their skills building something that we actually need, something that benefits the public good, the common good. Mm-hmm. Many of those factories, for example, could be adapted to build electric light rail cars. Many of them could be adapted to build wind turbines, to build solar panels and so forth. People need to be employed, obviously. They need jobs, but we need to be more thoughtful about the kinds of jobs we want to create.
In the essay titled Stillness,
yes,
you admit to the guilty indulgence of a small hut, mm-hmm, where you go to be alone, to work, to think, to be still and quiet. And you say, I drift so often into past and future, jerked around by memory and expectation, that I lose the savor of the moment. I have come to this empty room to break free of tasks and deadlines, to cast off worry and grief. And when I was reading this essay, I started to wonder if the nature of our frenetic lives has in itself rendered us incapable of stillness, particularly of stillness without solitude. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
We have to actually physically remove ourselves in order to get stillness. Is that...
Well, first of all, I admit in that essay, as you would have found in reading it, that I need to make a special effort to withdraw from the many, many activities I'm involved in order to gather myself, in order to have a certain clarity of mind. So that's a constant struggle for me, that is, I completely live in the hasty, accelerating, frenetic professional world, work world, that most of our listeners live in. And so I understand that. It doesn't come naturally to me to be quiet. I have to make special provision to do that. So to answer your question directly, solitude is necessary for me to find a degree of collectedness. As long as I'm involved in my work as a teacher, my work as a writer out in the world, I'm scattered. My attention is scattered. My energy is scattered in many, many different directions. The closest I come to a consistent meditative practice, I do some kinds of very amateurish but sincere sitting on a pillow meditation. I do that irregularly, but with great affection when I'm able to do it. But week in, week out, the kind of meditation that is most collecting for me, most gathering for me, is actually the practice of writing. Mm-hmm. When I'm at my keyboard composing something, and when the composing is actually going well, and much of the time, of course, it doesn't. I'm there, nothing's really working. But when it goes well, when the flow begins, I feel a sense of selflessness. That is, my whole awareness of myself as a person, as an ego, as a someone with lists of tasks to do and so forth, that all goes away, and I'm simply in the process of writing. Many artists, and I think carpenters and musicians and people in many different walks of life, occasionally experience this, so they would understand what it feels like to be in that, to be wholly given over to the work that you're doing. And it might only, that sense of flow may only be a few minutes long, or it might be a whole morning in rare instances. And when I emerge from it, blinking, I realize that this time has passed and there are words on the screen or on the page that have somehow come out of me, but they don't actually seem to have been produced by the small self that runs my life most of the time. They seem to have come from some larger self that is less hectic, less frantic. Ironically, that studio, the little study that where stillness, that essay, is set, in the essay I say that I'm not sure. My wife and I had this place, and the idea was that it would be a retreat place and that I would go there and write, and also just to withdraw from a pretty frantic lifestyle, but that I also felt guilty owning it. Mm-hmm. And I felt guilty because although we live in a very small house in town, it's a very nice house which my wife and I have restored inch by inch during the 30 plus years we've owned it. Very comfortable house. And so many people on earth do not have one roof over their heads. And here we owned two roofs, and it just seemed wrong. And in fact, I wasn't able to keep it. We decided to sell it. I just couldn't bear to feel that we had this extra place. And nobody else really was using it. We would loan it to friends periodically, but our kids had other places, our two children and their families had other places to go, and so they made very little use of it. So after a while, after maybe 7 or 8 years, my wife and I talked it through and decided we would sell it. So the place where that essay is set, we no longer own. An artist acquaintance of ours owns it, and she's making excellent use of it. She lives there. She makes excellent use of it. What we did do was the land that surrounds that place, we donated to the local land trust. Mm-hmm. It's all hardwood forest, beautiful hardwood forest. So that's now public land, publicly accessible land. It's owned by the nonprofit land trust. But I wasn't able to keep a retreat place just because I didn't feel justified in our owning it.
Yeah, that came through, that there was a certain conflict.
Yes.
For you. I want to back up 1 second. You mentioned losing yourself in the wonderful meditation of writing, and you mentioned a keyboard. Now, a lot of your work seems to have been written in a journal, and I'm curious, how much do you compose at the keyboard, and how much are you mostly journaling, and then...
Well, I use a journal. I have one in this satchel sitting on our table right now. I use a journal when I'm traveling, when I'm...
In the woods,
taking long
you're
walks.
Not taking
yes.
a computer in
right.
the woods.
Right, I never take the computer in the woods. When I'm in the woods, when I'm hiking, I have various different sized notebooks that are sticking in pockets here and there, and I write down notes. But my actual composing, where I'm writing something that I hope will become publishable, where I'm really composing some piece, an essay, a short story, I do all that at a keyboard. Mm-hmm. And I've been writing... And I say a keyboard, it's a computer keyboard, but I started writing in college on a manual typewriter. I learned in high school to touch type, which was actually a great skill to acquire. So from high school onward, I've been able to touch type, which means I don't have to look at my fingers. I just can look at the page or the screen, and therefore I can really invest my mind in the writing and not think about the mechanics of getting the words down.
I'm thinking this might be a good time for you to read.
Well, what I'm going to read is the last 2.5 pages of the book. It's from an essay called For the Children, and I take that title from a wonderful poem of the same title by Gary Snyder.
Okay.
And it's in the form of a letter addressed to children of the future, not any particular child, certainly not children who are biologically related to me, but just children of the future. And what I try to do in this letter for the children is to tell them what I have loved, what I have valued about the earth during my time alive, the creatures I've loved, the kinds of landscapes I've loved, and also what my hopes for them are, what I hope they will be able to experience when they live, when they come into the world. And so at the same time, I'm telling them, I'm speaking, of course, to the contemporary reader, to the present reader, and inviting the present reader to think about the effects of our lives on the prospects for future children. So this is just the last 2.5 pages. I don't think the listener needs any context. But I'm speaking to children of the future. When I think of all the wild pleasures I wish for you, the list grows long. I want you to be able to chase fireflies as they glimmer in long grass, watch tadpoles turn into frogs in muddy pools, hear loons calling on clear lakes, glimpse deer grazing and foxes ambling, lay your fingers in the paw prints of grizzlies and wolves. I want there to be rivers you can raft down without running into dams, the water pure and filled with the colors of sky. I want you to thrill in spring and fall to the ringing calls of geese and cranes as they fly overhead. I want you to see herds of caribou following the seasons to green pastures, turtles clamoring on shore to lay their eggs, alewives and salmon fighting their way upstream to spawn. And I want you to feel in these movements Earth's great age and distances, and to sense how the whole planet is bound together by a single breath. As I sit here in this shaggy backyard writing this letter to you, I remember a favorite spot from the woods behind my childhood house in Ohio, a meadow encircled by trees and filled with long grass that turned the color of bright pennies in the fall. I loved to lie there and watch the clouds as I'm watching the high, surly storm clouds rolling over me now. I want you to be able to lie in the grass without worrying that the kiss of the sun will poison your skin. I want you to be able to drink water from faucets and creeks, to eat fruits and vegetables straight from the soil. I want you to be safe from lightning and loneliness, from accidents and disease. I would spare you all harm if I could, but I also want you to know there are powers much older and grander than our own. Earthquakes, volcanoes, tornadoes, and thunderstorms, glaciers, floods. I pray that you will never be hurt by any of these powers, but I also pray that you will never forget them. And remember that nature is a lot bigger than our planet. It's the shaping energy that drives the whole universe, the wheeling galaxies as well as water striders, the shimmering pulsars as well as your beating heart. Thoughts of you make me reflect soberly on how I lead my life. When I spend money, when I turn the key in my car, when I vote or refrain from voting, when I fill my head or belly with whatever is for sale, when I teach students or write books, ripples from my actions spread into the future, and sooner or later they will reach you. So I bear you in mind. I try to imagine what sort of world you will inherit. And when I forget, when I serve only my own appetite, more often than not, I do something wasteful. By using up more than I need, I add to the flames that are burning up the blessings I wish to preserve for you. I worry that the choices all of us make today, in our homes and workplaces and offices and legislatures, will leave fewer choices for you and your own children and grandchildren 50 or 100 years from now. By indulging our tastes for luxuries, we may deprive you of necessities. Our laziness may cause you heavy labor. Our comfort may cause you pain. I worry that the world you find will be diminished from the one we enjoy. If Earth remains a blessed place in the coming century, you will hear crickets and locusts churring away on summer nights. You will hear owls hoot and whippoorwills lament. You'll smell wet rock, lilacs, new mown hay, peppermint, lemon balm, split cedar, piles of autumn leaves. On damp mornings, you'll find spider webs draped like handkerchiefs on the grass. You'll watch dragonflies zip and hover, then flash away so fast their wings thinner than whispers. You'll watch beavers nosing across the still waters of ponds, wild turkeys browsing in the stubble of cornfields, and snakes wriggling out of their old skins. If we take good care in our lifetime, you will be able to sit by the sea and watch the waves roll in, knowing that a seal or an otter may poke a sleek brown head out of the water and gaze back at you. The skies will be clear and dark enough for you to see the moon waxing and waning, the constellations gliding overhead, the Milky Way arching from horizon to horizon. The breeze will be sweet in your lungs, and the rain will be innocent. The rain has reached me now, rare drops at first, rattling the maple leaves over my head. There's scarcely a pause between lightning and thunder, and every loud crack makes me jump. It's time for me to get out from under this big old tree and go inside to keep this paper dry. So a few more words, my darlings, and then goodbye for now. Thinking about you draws my heart into the future. I want you to look back on those of us who lived at the beginning of the 21st century and know that we bore you in mind. We cared for you, and we cared for our fellow tribes, those cloaked in feathers or scales or chitin or fur, those covered in leaves and bark. One day it will be your turn to bear in mind the coming children, your turn to care for all the living tribes. The list of wild marvels I would save for you is endless. I want you to feel wonder and gratitude for the glories of Earth. I hope you will come to feel, as I do, that we are already in paradise, right here and now.
Thank you very much. That was Scott Russell Sanders reading from a Conservationist Manifesto published by Indiana University.
Yes.
I love that essay, and I love that ending. I'm glad you read it. I found myself, when I was reading that, somewhat chagrined that these things do still occur. These things still do exist, and to some extent, although I've enjoyed a lot of them, I've never seen a grizzly paw print, mm-hmm. and I've never seen the turtles clamber on shore to lay their eggs. And as I read this, and I think you said this before you read it, it struck me that the passive audience receiving this message now, as opposed to the children for whom you wrote it, may be the ones who have the power to change things.
Yes.
And or are the ones who have the power to change things. And that your goals will be best achieved by affecting that audience, today's readers, and hopefully someday the children can read it and feel that it was accomplished. So that's what you had in mind.
Yes, indeed. One doesn't have to have ever seen a grizzly paw print, as I have actually had the chance to see in Alaska and in Montana, or see turtles clambering on shore to lay their eggs, as I've also had the chance to see, or one doesn't have to ever have seen whales, to want them to be in the world,
right.
To want them to be available for other people to witness, or simply to know that they exist. For example, one of the arguments for drilling in the Arctic National Wild, drilling for oil and natural gas in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and there's an essay in here, as you know, about that proposal. One of the arguments is, well, so few people ever go up there to see the caribou migrating, to see the polar bears and so forth, so why should we protect it? And my argument is, it matters to me, although I have no plans to ever go there. It doesn't matter to me because I personally am going to benefit from it. It matters to me because there's a beauty alive there that is inherently valuable. And that for those who do go there, the people, the native people who live there, the few people who are able to go there, of course it's a cherished, treasured experience. But even if no human ever set foot there, it would be inherently valuable in my view. There's a great deal on this earth that we have already developed, to use that word, that we've already turned to our purposes. And it seems to me that we should leave what's left. We should leave the portions of the earth that we have not already exploited. And we should leave those for other creatures. And for those humans who are able and moved to go visit those places, to experience those places, that's all well and good. But I think that the primary reason for saving wild places is for the creatures that live there.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first half of a conversation with the writer Scott Russell Sanders. Next week, tune in to hear the second half of this interview. Write the Book is brought to you in part by Autism Support Daily, Vermont's first online support group and host of the annual Autism Walk each October at Battery Park. More information is available at autismsupportdaily.com or 802-985-8773. And by the Lake Champlain Regional Chamber of Commerce, promoting and supporting a healthy environment that makes Burlington the ideal place to live, work, visit, and do business. Located at 60 Main Street in Burlington and online at vermont.org. And by Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, building a brand new economy with old-fashioned values. Learn more at vbsr.org. And by Burlington Telecom, providing Burlington with access to the world, internet, television, telephone, burlingtontelecom.com, Burlington's fiber optic network. Just a couple of events on the Bookworm's calendar this week. First, Willem Lang reads from and signs copies of his new book, Favor Johnson, A Christmas Story, on Friday, November 27th at 11 at Bear Pond Books in Montpelier. And the Dorothy Alling Memorial Library in Williston will have a holiday decorating get-together on Monday, November 30th from 6 to 8. The snow date for this event is December 2nd. I should say that the views expressed on the Radiator are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WOMMLP, its management, board, or any of its affiliates. Today's Write the Book prompt was inspired by the work of my guest, Scott Russell Sanders. And I should say that next week we will have a writing prompt that he actually suggested for listeners. This one is inspired by his work. The excerpt that he read during our interview from his new book, A Conservationist Manifesto, is really intended for two audiences. Here's some of what he said as he introduced the pages he read during our interview. What I try to do is tell them what I have loved, what I have valued about the earth during my time alive, and also what my hopes for them are. At the same time, I'm speaking, of course, to the contemporary reader and inviting the present reader to think about the effects of our lives on the prospects for future children. As you write in the coming week, consider your audience. Who will read your words, and how would you like your work to impact those people? Do you want the reactions of your audience to affect the way you write, or would you rather just put words on paper, tell your story, convey your ideas? If you're writing an essay, as Scott Russell Sanders did in writing For the Children, you may well want to think about your audience ahead of time. If you're writing a poem, reacting to the world around you in a personal way, you may be less inclined to worry about how your reader will respond. In either case, this bears consideration. Who will read your work? How will they react? And is that important to the process of creation itself? A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And a reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events for the Bookworm's calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Here's a quick plug for a new Radiator show coming up in December. In the 1 o'clock time slot, the hour before this one, you'll be able to hear former Write the Book guest Laurel Nimi hosting her new show, The Wild Life, in which she interviews scientists, law enforcement officials, and others about the latest in wildlife research and investigation. The Radiator is able to bring you shows like The Wild Life and Write the Book and The World of Music thanks to community support and involvement. More information about how to support the station is available online at theradiator.org. Stay tuned. Cheryl Willoughby brings you The World of Music at 3 o'clock. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.